Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, David Weber. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I'm your host, and I also write science fiction and fantasy, which is why I started this. I've always enjoyed talking to other authors about their process and, that old perennial question, how do you come up with your ideas, and then how you develop those ideas, and how you write those ideas. And I figured that aspiring writers and readers would also be interested in that, especially of authors that they have enjoyed the work of over the years. Hence, The World Shapers. Now, I do have a novel of my own, which I would like to plug just at this moment, as I usually do, because this series is called The World Shapers, and my latest novel is, in fact, called World Shaper. It is, very briefly, set in a world that appears to be much like ours, except that the young woman who is the protagonist, Shauna Keys, who has a pretty good life going for herself as a potter in a small Montana city, discovers after something horrible happens that she's able to make unhappen, that in fact she is the shaper of the world, that she made it the way that it is, but she's about to lose it. An adversary has come in from another world and plans to take her world over and then kill her, and has already tried, but when she unmade what was happening, she reset time and he was taken away before he could actually kill her. But he's after her again. Carl Yatzer, who's shown up in this world ahead of the adversary, is looking for her, the Shaper, and having made contact with her, explains some of what's going on and says that she, in fact, can save many shaped worlds through this vast labyrinth of shaped worlds if she will come with him, because he thinks she has the power, because she showed it when she set time back 3 hours. She has the power to gather the knowledge of all these other shaped worlds and take them to Agrair, who's the mysterious person at the heart of the labyrinth. So in the first book, they have to stay one step ahead of the adversary and find the portal into the next world. And in subsequent books, because this is a series, Shauna will travel to many interesting worlds. I'm currently writing book 2, Master of the World, which is set in a kind of a Jules Verne-inspired steampunk world. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. So that's World Shaper. It's published by Daw Books. It's my 9th novel for Daw Books. You can find many others by me from Daw Books. If you are hearing this before January 1st, 2019, I am running a giveaway for World Shaper, an autographed copy of World Shaper. All you have to do is send me an email at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T, at gmail.com. And just put something in the subject line like World Shaper giveaway or something of that sort. And I will enter you, and then I will make the draw when New Year's rolls around. Okay, that's the obligatory self-promotional bit at the start of each one of these episodes of World Shaper. Now let's get down to what you're really here for, which is my conversation with David Weber. David Weber was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but he moved to Greenville, South Carolina by the time he was about 2 years old. Not by himself, his family went with him. And that's basically where he grew up. He obtained a Master of Arts degree in history at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. But although at one time he expected to teach history at the college level, instead he's been making his living in writing in one way or another since he was 17, although some of those early jobs included things like copywriter, typesetter, proofreader, and paste-up artist. It wasn't in the science fiction and fantasy field just yet, although he was certainly interested in all that. His first book was actually Insurrection, which was written with Stephen White and grew out of his work as a war game designer for the Task Force game Starfire. He has continued to write many more books since then, and his most famous series may be the Honor Harrington books, which we will be talking about in this podcast. They are, of course, space opera, but he has also written fantasy and many other things. He calculates that he's somewhere up around 47 books at this point, either published or in the works. He lives in Greenville, South Carolina, with his wife, Sharon, and they have three children and, quote, a passel of dogs, unquote. David Weber is one of my favorite authors, so I am very happy to welcome him to The World Shapers.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I don't know if you remember, but I think we met at Conversion in Calgary a few years ago. That convention doesn't exist anymore, but I remember you were a guest, and I think we were even on a panel together, although I don't have a clue what the panel might have been.
I've been doing them for, 28 years now. So there have been a few.
Yeah, just a few. And you go to a lot of conventions too, don't you?
A fair number. The worst was the year that we didn't realize that we double booked and we had 13. That will keep you busy.
If I do three in a year, I think I've done a lot. So,
well, we usually try to hit four to five is our target. Sharon and I were trying to count them up the other day, and we were up to a dismaying total.
Well, we're going to focus a little later on specifically on your creative process when it comes to the Honor Harrington books. We'll talk about your other books too. But first, I like to take the guests back into the depths of time and ask that perennial question of, how did you start doing all this? When did you start writing?
Well, I started writing in the fifth grade, I think. That was when I first started putting words on paper. We had the Greenville Arts Festival down here in Greenville, South Carolina at one point. Was purely unpublished amateur writers. I did pretty well in that, in like the 16 to 22 category. I've supported myself either by writing or doing things associated with it. Seriously, ever since I was 17 years old, I've set type. I'm one of the world's last trained linotype operators. I also know how to do paste up, which no one does anymore because now you use computers to set everything up. I thought in Y2K, you know, those earlier career choices might be making a comeback, but alas, I was wrong.
Well, I worked at a weekly newspaper in the 80s. I was a reporter and editor. We still had a linotype machine, and they were still using it for job printing, although I never learned how to operate it. But I did learn how to do paste-up.
Yes.
So I'm with you on that one.
Yes, we dinosaurs must hang together.
And we used to type everything on manual typewriters and hand it off to somebody else to typeset, too. So
yeah. I remember something that Robert Asprin said at a convention one time. He said, professional writers are like rats. If we don't wear our fingers down on the keyboard every day, our fangs grow through our brains and kill us. Bob and I didn't get along in every way, but that one we absolutely were in agreement on. And I think that in my case, I probably started putting words on paper for my own amusement. The first novel-length manuscript I ever did was in the 10th grade. I can't imagine not writing for my own pleasure, if not for anything else. It's simply what I do. So the first novel was actually a consequence of some war game design that I was doing. My friend Steve White, who I'd met because he had issues with an earlier war game that I was involved with, started exchanging short stories because I always wrote a short story to kind of set the mood for the scenarios in any of the games that I was working on. And I sent that story to Steve, and that inspired him to send one back to me, and I sent one to him, and he sent one to me, and I realized that what we were doing was writing a novel based on the scenarios I'd constructed for the for the war game. And that is how Insurrection came into existence. And in its initial karma, it was a brief little missive of 283,000 words, which had to be pruned down somewhat if you were going to sell a first novel. And it took us a while, but Bain bought it in 89. I think it came out in early 91. Might have been 90. But that was how I got the first novel published.
Well, when did you develop an interest in science fiction and fantasy? Was that back when you were writing as a kid? Is that what you started out writing, or?
Oh, goodness. I met science fiction when I was 10 years old. I had broken an arm and therefore was somewhat restricted in my mobility. And I read my dad's Fantasy Press hardcover of Jack Williamson's Legion of Space.
Mm.
That was the first science fiction novel I ever read. The second was Sprague de Camp and P. Schuller Mitchell's Genus Homo, which is actually pretty good. It's sort of a predecessor for The Planet of the Apes, really. If nobody has ever read it, they should. And after that, I was already reading Stephen Mead, Saber Pilot, and books like, you know, You Were There at the Battle of Lexington and Concord, Swallows and Amazons. I was pretty...
Oh, Swallows and Amazons. Now, I always love it when somebody mentions those because they were one of mine.
Yes. I was the classic promiscuous reader, and my parents' position was that we could read anything we wanted to, because if we were old enough to understand it, we could handle it. If we weren't old enough to understand it, it would sail right past us. But I have to say that the smorgasbord of reading opportunities was probably less likely to take you to really odd places then than it is now. So perhaps that's one reason they were a little calmer about what I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I got in trouble in the fifth grade for taking Daniel Defoe's Roxana or The Fortunate Mistress to class with me, with the original 16th century woodcuts in it of the naked ladies hopping in and out of bed. My fifth grade teacher did not react calmly to that. My father had to explain to the principal that it was what is known as literature, you cretin. it was a very interesting conversation. I would say that it had to be Heinlein's Juveniles.
Yeah.
Andre Norton.
Mm-hmm.
Was, you know, they're the ones that drew me into science fiction.
Me too.
I loved H. Beam Piper, read Mac Reynolds, Gordy Dixon. There were quite a few folks that I was reading at that point, most of whom, alas, are no longer with us. I think virtually all of them probably that I was reading at that time, actually, now that I think about it. I remember reading Annie McCaffrey's first Pern novel, serialized in Analog, when I was in high school.
Mm.
So that's what drew me to science fiction. The first novel that I actually submitted and which was rejected was fantasy. And it has since been published as The Sword of the South. The fantasy novel that came out about a year and a half ago, that the manuscript and the discs for that novel were lost, and nobody saw any of them for like 8, 9, 10 years, and then one of the floppies turned up, and it was old enough that it was one of the big floppies, and it was CPM, not DOS, you know. And then about 8 months later, the second one turned up, and there was actually an IT shop here in town that, for a mere $800, was able to recover the files. And they recovered every word of the novel. The problem, of course, was that there were hard carriage returns at the end of each line. So I wound up rewriting it, although it's still very close to the original novel. Most of the rewrite was because I had done other novels set in the same universe that that changed things that I had done originally.
Would you have submitted that then before Insurrection came around, or was this something that
Yes. It was in submission before Insurrection, and it was rejected because it, for obviously not good reasons, but it was rejected in one case because it didn't have a credible villain. And I couldn't quite figure out what else I needed to do to turn Wolfra into a credible villain, since she had murdered her father, murdered her sister, murdered her king. Sent a dragon to eat 600 people trying to get one person allied with the evil wizards on the other continent. You know, the only thing I could figure out is that when she finally had to face the music and she knew she was going to be destroyed by the powerful white wizard, she didn't say, "Oh, please, please don't hurt me." She more or less said, "Well, I took my best shot. Go ahead." And that's the only thing I could think of. I was like, you know, what the heck?
Well, editors, you know. You actually studied history originally, didn't you?
Yes, military and diplomatic history. I thought forever and ever that I was going to teach college history and write on the side. And then I was finishing up my master's degree, and I came across a study of the demographics in the field. And it was like half or more of all tenured positions were currently held by people who were 40 or younger, which explained why some of the professors that I had were at the schools they were at rather than at, you know, frontline big-name universities. And I decided at that point that I should probably alter my priorities. So I went back into advertising, took over my mother's small agency. She had retired to care for her mother, who was then in her 80s. I sold the first novel about a year and a half after that. And that would be Insurrection. And I was fortunate enough that I was able to support myself writing full-time within 18 months or so of making the first sale.
The copywriting experience, do you think that has been helpful to you in your career? I mean, my experience, again, going back to the weekly newspaper, I was writing a column, I was writing news items, I was writing three or four features a week. And, you know, there was no time to sit and think, I can't write. You sat down at the keyboard and you wrote.
Yeah, I think that most people who have been copywriters or production journalists, and I've been both, they learn to not block because, you know, blocking is not an option. Now, I will say that there are times when I can edit but not write, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just have to deal with those as I come along. But that's the story writing perspective. That's not the writing per se. I have never had a time when I couldn't sit down and put words on paper that made sense. There were just times when I was stuck on where I was trying to take the story, and I had to stop and think about it.
Well, thinking is also a form of writing.
Well, it is. It is. I tell people that you know, writing is the medium through which I tell the story. Okay, it's the story that matters. And I will say that I think that it is the writer's voice that wins or loses a readership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two different writers can tell exactly the same story. One of them will succeed, the other one will fail with a given readership because of the manner in which they tell the story. And I firmly believe that, I've said this many times at cons, that a weak story which is strongly told will succeed where a strong story that is weakly told fails.
That works for me.
Yeah. Well, and that's when you get down to looking at the craft of writing. I'm not one of the people who regards it as the masterpiece of art. I have passages, I have entire books that I'm very proud of, But by and large, to me, if the style becomes sufficiently important that it begins drawing the reader's attention away from the story, then the style has failed, is the way that I see it. And I think that writing is something that is sort of like it's like a physical skill. You learn it by doing it. And if you've done copy edit, if you've done copywriting, as you and I have, if you've had to deal with a client who is wrong but insists on having it done his way, so it then becomes your job to do the wrong thing as well as you can, then you gain that ability to shape the style of the story to the feel of the story, I think.
Well, the specific series of stories we're going to focus on here is the Honor Harrington books. For somebody who has never read Honor, I know that's hard to imagine such a person exists.
Oh, no. There are several of them out there.
How would you synopsize the series?
Well, I usually start by saying, Honor Harrington is a 6'2" Eurasian female martial artist starship captain. That kind of packs everything, you know, from where she starts out. The Honor Harrington books are both are and aren't about Honor Harrington. Honor is definitely the focusing point for the majority of the stories, but they actually are about the entire war, the entire series of wars that she is involved in. And the first several books are very tightly focused on her. And then as the war begins to spread, it becomes a broader canvas. There are a lot of secondary characters in my books, named characters. I hate passages where you have somebody who is called the lieutenant 17 times. Mm-hmm. There's a name. Okay, this is a person. And so I try to make the lieutenant a person. And in my character notes, there's something about that named character that is my little hook for them, you know, further down the road. Honor begins as a young for her civilization. They have something called Prolong. So although she's like 42, she's like a baby, you know, in terms of her projected 300-year plus lifespan, in command of her first light cruiser. And she manages to get herself and her cruiser exiled to the punishment station of the Royal Manticoran Navy because she has political enemies going in from some stuff that happened at the academy, and also because she embarrasses a prominent admiral, and this is an aristocratic society. It's not the kind of aristocratic society where commoners are, you know, forget about it, you're done. But it is one where birth is a definite advantage. And Honor at that point in her career is a tactically brilliant but politically very naive officer. And she is simply determined that she's going to do her duty, whatever happens. And so, of course, she manages to create a political firestorm in the process. But she survives, her crew survives, and she goes on to bigger and more large scale, I guess you would say, challenges.
Yes, the canvas definitely expands enormously over the course of the series. And I just read the most recent one, Uncompromising Honor. So I'm right up to date there.
I spent 25 years on the series to date. So it growed. I originally projected the entire series to go maybe 8 books. And I think there are currently like 17 novels and 6 anthologies counting the collaborations with Eric Flint and Jane Linscold and Tim Zahn and Tom Pope. There are quite a few in the Honorverse.
Well, how did it grow? How did it start? I think you had given several ideas to your editor, and this was one that was picked. Is that how that went?
Yeah, sort of. Jim Bain had observed that everything I wrote seemed to spawn sequels. Because, you know, I got to the end of the story and I wanted to know what happened next, so I would begin doing the sequel. And he suggested that since I seemed to be a natural for writing series, that here was a radical thought. Why didn't we plan a series as one from the beginning? I said, okay, and I sent him about 10 ideas. One of them was Honor Harrington. One of them was what ultimately became the Safehold series with Tor. One of them was the Multiverse series that began with Hell's Gate. One of them was yet another series idea that I finally have the first volume in that series coming out, co-authored with Jacob Holo in May from Bain. So there were, you know, basic things, stories that I really wanted to tell. Now, what I didn't know when I submitted this was that Jim had been looking for somebody to do Horatio Hornblower in space for like 25 years. So I don't think he read any of them except for the one that began Honor Harrington as a 6'2" female Eurasian starship captain. And he said, write him a contract for 2 books. No, make it 3. Hell, make it 4. And at that point, you know, a 4-book contract was huge in my ability to devote full time to writing the series. And we released the first two like a month apart. And I think that was brilliant marketing on Jim's part, because here was the first book. And if people started looking, bang, here was the next one right after it. Plus sort of the promise that there really was going to be a series, if you see what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I don't believe there was a person ever in the publishing industry who understood how to grow a new author's readership the way that Jim Bain did. The fact that we lost him so young, I mean, you know, he was 52, I think, when we lost him. It's just, I think a lot of people don't realize what a loss to science fiction publishing in general that was.
One of the things that he did, and this is the way I discovered your books, I had an early ebook reader, and I was looking for material for it. It was a high book. This was a Korean-made thing with a LCD screen. And I found the Bain Free Library, and that's when I started Honor Harrington. And as I just said, I've read every novel, I think, in the series. So that was one of the things he did that was quite, foresight. A lot of foresight there.
Honor Harrington was in the first tranche of the Bain Free Library, and I believe that it did nothing but increase readership. The internet is the world's biggest library shelf. And the rule of thumb used to be that for every book that you put on a library shelf, you sold 6 of the same title. And I haven't seen anything coming out of the free library that causes me to think that's not still the case. But the another thing that Bain did before ebooks became as commonly available as they are, is they would bind CDs with all the earlier books in a series into the back of the hardcover release of a new book in a series.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so you could, if you bought like War of Honor, you got all the earlier books in the series plus half a dozen other authors. You know, here's a book by them. I think that was another case. Spider Robinson once said that Jim Bain seemed to be the only science fiction publisher who actually wanted to live in the 21st century. And I think he was right, which makes it even sadder that he got to see so little of the 21st century. But he had, he pointed the way in a lot of ways. The Bain eARCs are still, I think, unique in the industry. Readers can buy electronic copies of the ARC direct from Bain, and so that they can compare the original manuscript that goes into the advanced reader's copies with the final manuscript. And I don't think anybody else is doing that even now.
Mm. Well, we're talking about technology. Of course, one of the things in Honor Harrington is there is an enormous amount of technology described in great detail. How did you go about developing that? You have a very unique, I hate that, not very unique. It's not unique or it isn't unique. you have a unique faster-than-light system. And, of course, your weapons are detailed and the way that they work is very important to how the story progresses. So how did you develop all that?
Well, part of that is probably my war game designing background. Another part of it is the fact that I've been studying military and diplomatic history literally since I was 10 years old, 11 years old. My son, by the way, is falling into the same the same black hole right now as we speak. He's 16 in December, and history is clearly his subject. Part of the before I wrote the first word of On Basilisk Station, the first Honorverse novel, I wrote roughly 85,000 word essay on the Honorverse, what the technology was, what the pattern of colonization was, what the life sciences were, the history of the development of the impeller drive, the whole nine yards. And so I got all those thoughts down before I began actually writing the book. The technology, in part, grew out of the story that I wanted to tell. There were aspects of the technology that were shaped in order to let me tell the specific type of story that I wanted to tell about Honor and the Star Kingdom. And it was important that there be tactical constraints. My feeling is that in a lot of ways, the story is about what your character can't do, not what your character can do. It's about the limitations that they have to work around and how intelligently they use the tools and the advantages they have to accomplish whatever their task or their mission is. On the way in which the hardware interfaces, I had decided going in that the technology was going to evolve in the course of the novels. So it was not going to be that they would be fighting the battles in the 10th year of the war with the same weapons with which they started the war. And I had also decided that I was going to have a numerically hugely outweighed society that my heroine would be from up against this, this huge giant of an opponent, and that the technology was going to have to be the equalizer, and that therefore the small guys who had seen that this war was coming would have invested heavily in R&D at a time when technology had kind of plateaued for war fighting for a couple of centuries, as far as everybody else was concerned. So there was a lot going on when I started thinking about how I wanted the technology to work. And because I've always been interested in tactics as well as the operational and the strategic level of military history, I wanted a tech that would require tactical thinking, that wasn't just here we are with our fleet in space, there's the other fleet in space, now we start blasting off missiles, and whoever has the most missiles wins. in some ways, the Honorverse sort of turned into that by the end because of the sheer size of the fleets involved. But even at the very end of the where we are right now in the series, tactics are still critically important, especially in smaller ship engagements. So I needed a system that would give scope to a tactician who was smart, and one which would create limitations on how you could approach a combat situation. And then it had to be something that the reader could understand, so that the reader would the reader had to understand the menu of options available to the characters in order to understand why a character did what he or she did. That was my feeling, at any rate. And so I had to make the technology both, as I use the term creatively, realistic as possible, as limited as possible, as specific as possible, and yet also have it be accessible to the reader who liked nuts and bolts. And that all got mixed up together to create the tech system of the Honorverse. Now, people need to remember that the first two novels in this series were written a year before the internet became available. So there are certain starting assumptions that if I were beginning anew today might be different. All in all, I think my starting assumptions held up pretty well. But there are a few things that I wish were different in the light of some development since then, but they're grandfathered into the series. I can't change them without invalidating the earlier books.
One of the things that I always found interesting, and I was reading the last book with, you know, because I knew I was going to be talking to you. Mm-hmm. Often we will get, or you will present details of the weapon system while we are in the midst of an engagement. And it's an interesting effect in that you are reading this and, you know, got to devour all this technical information because you know at the end of it, something's going to blow up. And it's an interesting way of building suspense, I think. Well, I don't know if I've seen it done quite that way anywhere else.
Well, you know, it works for some people, and other people are like, oh my God, he's going to tell me how to fire a muzzle-loading cannon, you know, kind of thing.
It works, and Safehold is the same thing.
I think this goes back to what I was saying about the writer's voice. This is the natural way for me to tell the story. And I can use that as a means to accelerate or decelerate the action at the same time that it's serving the function of telling the reader, okay, this is why the folks involved in this battle are really sweating what just happened or is about to happen. And I'm not sure that it is a technique that would work for other writers. It's one that works for me. I have people who tell me, and this convinces me that I'm pretty much got the right mix, because I got people who say to me, man, I my eyes glaze over when you start telling me all about the hardware, but I love the characters and the combat sequences. And I'll have somebody else say, man, you know, I'm not really into all that combat, but the way you develop the societies and the political systems is really cool, and I love the characters. And I have other people who tell me, you know, like, well, you know, I'm not that much into the hardware or the politics, but the way you develop all the different planets and cultures involved, and I love the characters, okay? And I think it's the characters that's the common factor, but the fact that I have so many people reading the books for so many different aspects of them convinces me that I must have hit just about the right balance.
Well, the other
presenting the story.
The other thing that has struck me as well is that, you know, there's the old saying that military life in a time of war is long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. And I think that comes through in the books as well, when, you know, people are just patrolling and nothing is happening and nothing is happening and nothing is happening. And then all of a sudden things all are
kinds,
happening.
All kinds of things are happening. Well, yeah. Well, the other thing is that I had done three or four novels with different types of technology, different types of interstellar drives and whatnot, prior to the Honorverse, and I didn't want to repeat what I had done in the earlier books, which was one factor, for example, in why there's no neural interfacing with computers in the Honorverse. I mean, I did that in Dahak, in Mutineer's Moon, in Path of the Fury. It's why there's no fully aware, self-aware AI. The Honorverse has an operating assumption that you can't create a self-aware artificial intelligence. All you can really do is create increasingly brilliant software that counterfeits it. And that was deliberate because I just finished doing Mutineer's Moon with Dahak, the supercomputer, which is totally self-aware. So all of that kind of went into how I built the storyline going forward. But one of the factors that I deliberately built out of the Honorverse, if you will, was any means of interstellar faster than light communication. So the only way that messages, that information can move is aboard a starship, once you get into outside a star system. And that had very interesting and significant implications for military operations. And part of it is what you're talking about. You spend a lot of time going from point A to point B, where nothing much is happening. I don't spend a lot of time on it in the books, but the characters do between times when I'm blowing them up, they get to be bored. But it also means that a huge amount devolves onto the initiative of the station commanders, the task force commanders, because they're back where they were in the 18th or the 19th century, in that nobody can micromanage from Washington or London or Moscow. That national command authority doesn't know what's happening until a courier gets home with a dispatch that says either we have met the enemy and they are ours, or, oh crap, the invasion fleet will be along shortly. And that is a big part, I think, of the flavor of the books, because it lets me take a character like an Honor Harrington and cut her loose from the apron strings, if you will, where she is constantly aware that she represents her queen and her star kingdom. And that informs a lot of her decisions. You can see it very, very clearly in Honor of the Queen, where she takes on an overwhelmingly powerful opponent, knowing that her ship will almost certainly be destroyed without managing to stop the attack, because it's her job as the representative of her queen to do that. And I think that's part of what makes Honor so beloved of the people who have followed the books for as long as they have. I knew going in that her first name was going to be Honor. That was a deliberate choice on my part. And then as I worked on the essay, I realized that if this series worked, it would be compared probably to C.S. Forster's Hornblower novels. And so I decided Harrington had both, it was nice euphonious Honor Harrington, and it also would be sort of a nod to Forster to give her the same initials that Horatio had. She's not Horatio Hornblower. She's somebody else, but she's definitely in the same family.
Well, there's some other, and of course, you're a history guy, and I know this is deliberate, the historical parallels there. I mean, the Star Kingdom is roughly analogous to England, and the Republic of Haven is France.
I know. No, right down no, to... No. I that was my red herring. I
had oh, it is. My,
oh, yes. Well,
Rob Pierre.
Yes, well, okay, they are French, but if you really look at it, they are not the French Republic. They certainly didn't become the People's Republic from the Kingdom of France. They became the People's Republic from the United States of America, if you actually look at their constitution and how it was written. And I'm busy waving the French Republic over here with my left hand just as hard as I can to keep the writer's attention. The readers are all looking at Esther McQueen and saying, ah, this is Napoleon, this is Napoleon, aha, aha. And then she's dead. And they're like, wait, what happened? And what's happening is I introduced you to the person who was going to be the critical Havenite reform leader in the second book, Thomas Theisman, mm-hmm. who was going to be Cincinnatus down the road. And I was working really, really hard to keep the reader from figuring out that that was where I was going with it. And I think it worked. I don't think a lot of people saw Tom coming any more than Oscar Saint-Just did.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, well, you know, that was where... I don't know why people keep calling me sneaky. I have no idea why they do that. but yeah, there's... I deliberately used my knowledge, my understanding, my love of history to create something. I gave you the tennis court oath, for God's sake, you know, to make sure that you knew this was the French Revolution, because it wasn't. And I've had some people who have come up to me and said, I'm going to get you for this someday, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, that's obviously my use of history. If people actually go back and look at my books, I use history a lot, but I use it as building blocks more than I do as an operating model. Initially, I was going to do... the Honorverse as more of Carthage and Rome than, except with Carthage winning. and I was looking more at a Punic Wars model, but the problem is that I was thinking at that point in terms of planetary combat, and I realized as I built the tech system that planetary combat was going to be the vanishingly rare exception rather than the rule, because once you controlled the space around a planet, you were in a position to annihilate anybody at the bottom of the gravity well without working up a sweat, so that you weren't going to have too many contested landings and that kind of thing. So I moved more towards the Napoleonic model for fleet combat, and away from my original Punic Wars thought. But I never intended the model that I had built to be anything more than the starting point for cultures that were, you were then going to find out, had gone in different directions that you said to yourself, okay, I know what he's going to do here, and then you found out that I was doing something else.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I've found, that the parallels quickly broke down as the story went along.
Yeah, and the longer that you insisted on hanging on to the parallels, I think the bigger the surprise was when you finally realized that I was going somewhere else entirely all along.
When you're starting one of these books, what does your planning look like? Do you do a detailed outline? Does some of it happen on the fly? How does it work for you?
Well, as I said, when I started the Honorverse, I wrote a very lengthy little monograph for myself. I refer to it as the Tech Bible for the Honorverse. And I pretty much spelled out what was going to happen in the war, not specifically with Honor, in my tech documents, through probably Honor Among Enemies. And I knew where Honor was going to begin. And I knew that, unlike a certain captain whose initials are JTK, that it was Starship Command might have been the thing she was best at, but it wasn't what she was going to do for her entire career. That she was going to, there were going to be roadblocks, there were going to be, you know, obstacles to promotion, but the fact that this is a capable, dedicated, courageous naval officer means that eventually she's going to get promoted. Now, I had originally planned to kill her off in the book that became At All Costs. She was supposed to die in that book. In my original visualization of the Cosmic All, that was where she was supposed to die. And Eric Flint messed that up a little bit because he was doing some, he was writing in the Honorverse with me. And he wanted something that a Havenite and a Manticoran secret agent could agree that they both hated enough they'd go in together on it. And I gave him the genetic slave trade. And in the process, we pulled a plot strand about 20 years forward. I hadn't realized we were doing that. And that meant that there wasn't time for Honor to die and for her children to become the central viewpoint characters of the ongoing plot line. So if you've read At All Costs, her role and Alistair McKeon's in that book got flipped when I got there. She was supposed to hold the ring until Alistair could come to the rescue, and she was supposed to die in the process, and it worked the other way around. I think the readers would have forgiven me in my original karma because of the way in which she would have died, if you see what I'm saying. It would have been sort of the culmination and the perfection of what she had lived her entire life to be and to do. I won't pretend that I was brokenhearted when I realized that I couldn't kill her off. And not just because the character had become so successful with the readership, but because I had come to care so deeply about the character. And I've killed characters that, man, it hurt as the author to write the death scene. And this would have definitely been one of them. But I have a rule, which is that I'm writing military fiction, and most people's experience with violence is, at least in the First World, is vicarious. We really don't, we're all, we talk about what a violent society the U.S. is, for example. People who have firsthand experience with organized violence are a very small percentage of the total population. So we form our views of it through what we see on the news, what we see in our TV entertainment, what we see in movies, what we read in books. And I think that it's important for someone who's going to write military science fiction to deal with the fact that this is an ugly, ugly thing. It can be a very noble calling, and I seriously believe that, to voluntarily place, as Heinlein would say, you know, place yourself between your home and war's desolation. And I think that the profession of arms is one that is worthy of deep respect. But the fact is that, as a friend of mine who was a Special Forces officer for 20 years put it, we do a whole lot of things we wish nobody had to do. And one of the things that happens in war is that it's not just bad guys who die. And so you have to be willing, if you're going to be fair with the story and with the weight of the story that you're telling, you have to be willing to kill characters that you know your readers love. And it's hard on you and it's hard on them, but that's part of what a combat situation is about. That and the fact that there are always, always, always going to be collateral casualties, and you can't avoid it. You can't clean it up. And so I try to show that too, that you know, war is just, however exciting it may be, it is a voracious, vile devourer of human life.
You, talking about the characters and that you care about and that readers care about, you do a fairly detailed character sketches for anybody before you write the book. Is that how you work?
No, well, usually as I'm, okay. Probably the only person that I did a detailed character sketch on before I started writing the Honorverse was Honor. And even that I would not call at all detailed in terms of where she finally wound up, if you see what I'm saying. Normally when I develop a character, I start with a physical description. Usually there is some aspect of their personality that I think of as the hook. That is my, okay, this is my periscope into the character. And then as I go along, as the character interacts, I go back to the character list and I add notes. I said, oh, okay, after I found out when she had this conversation with Honor that she likes chess, you know, so I go over and stick that in, that kind of thing. When I am writing solo, I do not tend to outline. Now, the last half dozen, four or five half dozen Honor Harrington novels, Honorverse novels, that's not true of, because the war had become so complex, spread over such a broad volume, that I had to be pretty meticulous about where, what, when, and how things were happening. So I have a very, very detailed timeline for the last 5-6 years of the war, in which it's like, you know, task group so-and-so departs Manticore for the Lynx Terminus. And then I'll, you know, have an entry, task force so-and-so arrives Lynx Terminus, so that I've got all this reference material where I need it. But I don't do an outline that projects in detail where I'm going to go. This is more of a record of where I've been and of how long it's going to take information to get from point A to point B or something like that. Now, when I do a collaboration like the ones with Eric or the ones that Tim Zahn and Tom Pope and I are doing in the Manticore Ascendant series, there I tend to do a much more detailed synopsis, at least, of where the story is going. Usually it's, okay, this is what I need the story to accomplish. This is where we're beginning. This is what I want to be kind of the critical action in it. And then we kick it around, and there's input from all parties into where the story finally winds up. But when you're working with another writer, you have to be on the same page, I think, in a way that you don't when you're writing solo and you can shift gears anytime you suddenly realize that you had a better idea. I have what I refer to as the ooh shiny moment when I'm going along and I suddenly stop and go, oh, wait, what if, you know? And I can do that in a solo book. I can let it go wherever it wants to go in a very, I guess, organic sort of way. But you can't do that if you're working with another writer, because they're writing in good faith to get to point B, and all of a sudden you're headed off to point J, and they're like, wait, you know, what am I supposed to do now? So the answer is I do and I don't outline. It depends on the nature of the work process. I do tend to have an idea, a very clear idea of where a series is going to begin and end, and a feel for what's going to happen out in the middle. But I'm very much improvising on the theme as I go along in terms of getting from A to B.
Do you have, what's your rewriting process look like? Do you have to do a lot of rewriting? Do you produce pretty clean stuff the first time around, or how does it work for you?
When I'm actually in the groove, I'm knocking out between 5,000 and 7,500 words a day. The most I've ever done in a single day was 34,000 words, and then I slept for a couple of days. But my writing process is that before I begin on the day's work, I go back and reread and revise and tweak the previous 2 days' work.
Mm.
So that every time, every portion of the book has been revised and tweaked at least 3 times by the time I get to the end of the book. And this does a couple of things. One is, I think, obviously, it gives me an opportunity to strengthen and clean up as I go along. But it also builds what I think of as storytelling momentum for the day's work. Okay, this is my stretching exercise for today's work, is looking at what I did for the last 2 days and getting back into that I am the storyteller mode before I hit the today's chunk of the story. Also, about 20 years ago, I reduced my right wrist to gravel on an icy steps. I broke it into 58 pieces.
Ugh.
And they got 57 of them put back. There was one teeny one they didn't. But in place for that one little teeny sliver of bone, they gave me like 2 plates and 12 screws and 6 pieces of wire and bone spurs and early onset arthritis and, you know, all kinds of bad stuff. So, And I was a linotype operator, so I really, you know, I type hard even today because I'm used to the linotype keyboard. I used one for too long. So I'm at a situation where I can only type for about 45 minutes before my right hand packs up on me, and it's getting worse as time goes on. So I could type about 110 words a minute. Before the damage to the hand. But since I wrecked the wrist, I have been using Dragon Naturally Speaking to write. And I can dictate 250 words a minute. Now, I don't know anybody who can write at 250 words a minute. But it does accelerate, I think, the writing process to not have to be constrained by the speed of the keyboard, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I did discover when I switched over to Dragon that I had learned to compose sentences at my typing speed that I was keeping up with, because with the Dragon, I can get ahead of my thoughts, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The other thing about Dragon is Dragon really prefers complete sentences. Because it's extrapolating meaning when something isn't clear to it. And that actually means that I have a tendency to think more now in complete sentences than I did when I was writing with a keyboard. It's really kind of interesting when you sit and you look back at how the way in which you get those photons corralled on the display affects the way in which you think about what you're doing.
I've used Dragon for a nonfiction project, which it was very helpful because it had quite a few direct quotes and you could just read the direct quotes as opposed to having to retype them. So it was very, very useful in that regard.
Well, the big thing is the Dragon doesn't care whether or not it's the right word. It only cares that it's spelled correctly.
Yeah.
So there's some things that it does that you just have to say, okay, I have to go back and look for this in the proofread.
Yeah, for sure. Well, getting close to end of our hour here. So I wanted to go to the big philosophical question, which is, why do you write? Why do you think any of us write? And specifically, why do you write this stuff? Science fiction, fantasy.
Well, I think that most people who write, or at least who write the kind of stuff that I write, we are We are storytellers. That's what we love to do. We love to create and craft stories. And we communicate, we share those stories by writing them down. But I guess it's much the same thing that I guess would be part of someone who paints, and who paints imaginary landscapes that they've never actually seen. I am fascinated by history. I am fascinated by the way that people's personalities work and how that motivates them to be who and what they are in real life. And telling stories is a way that lets me get inside that process. I think that people who don't like history, for example, I honestly believe that almost anyone could learn to love history if you could just get them to understand that it is the greatest, most complex novel ever written. That you have all of these characters in here, all of whom have their own motivations, all of whom have their own responsibilities. How do they meet them? This is part of what makes us human beings and defines the difference between responsible, conscientious human beings and the predators. And I think that I tell stories in part because that's what I want to look at. I mean, obviously, I want to entertain my readership. And I don't want to be, you know, in a position of lecturing. But any writer, the moment that he or she begins to write, steps up onto a soapbox. Because if I present a character who would be unsympathetic to you if under normal circumstances, but I get you inside that character and make the character's views might not be those that you would espouse on your own, but you discover that you like this character, and then you find out that that character's views aren't your own. Then I have made those contrarian views more accessible to you. And frankly, I think that's something that we are in, especially these days, in sad need of. And it's why I play fair with the quote bad guys in the books. It's why there are characters who are just as sympathetic wearing the other side's uniform. Because they are decent human beings, even if they come from a different value system, and even if they are trying to kill your friends right this minute, they're doing it for reasons, not all of them, but at least some of them are doing it for the same reasons you are. They're defending their country. They're serving their cause. And to me, that's what being a human being is all about. And to me, good storytelling is about the human condition. Science fiction is a technological age's fairy tales. It serves the same functions. It's inspirational. It's cautionary. It's explicative. It's all of those things. We just, instead of using demigods and demons and whatnot, we've got scientists and cyborgs and computers. But we're looking at the same issues, the same questions. And those issues and those questions are, what makes us human? And what is involved in living up to your responsibilities as a human? And that's, you can see that in Robert Heinlein, in I think all really good science fiction. I mean, I remember Heinlein's, you know, greater love hath no man than a mother cat dying to defend her kittens. It's a very profound statement that cuts to the heart of what it is to be human. And I think that's what I write about. And I don't usually get quite that highfalutin in my efforts to explain it, but I think that's what pushes me to write.
And what are you working on now?
Oh, well, let's see. Right this minute, I am working on 4 collaborations. A sequel to Out of the Dark, which I think I mentioned is coming in May from Bain with Jacob Hullo. Chris Kennedy and I are working on the sequel to Out of the Dark. We're calling it creatively Into the Light from Tor. Tim and Tom and I are working on Call to Insurrection, which is the 4th book, I think, in the Manticore Ascendant series, which is set like 200-300 years before Honor's time. Eric Flint and I are about to begin work on the sequel to Cauldron of Ghosts, which is contemporaneous with, or actually comes a little after, Uncompromising Honor, which you've just finished reading. Jane Linscold and I are going to be doing another of the Star Kingdom novels with Stephanie Harrington and company. My next solo project for Bain will be the sequel to Sword of the South. So it'll be fantasy, not science fiction. And my next solo project in the Honorverse will actually be the story of Honor's father's Marine career, and why he decided he better stop being a Marine because he was too good at killing people and become a doctor instead. And in January, Tor is releasing Through Fiery Trials, the next Safehold novel. So my actual solo writing schedule will probably be sequel to Sword of the South, then sequel to Through Fiery Trials, and then the story of Alfred Harrington's Marine career. But as you can see, I have a few irons in the fire. I realized a few years ago, actually about two years ago, when I hit the wall physically and was pretty much worked myself into a state of exhausted collapse, that I did not have the time to tell all the stories that I need to tell all by myself. So I am going out and recruiting some help to get some of them told. And so far, it's been working out pretty well.
And where can people find you online?
They can find me online at davidweber.net. And I am I tend to be there for like be there in depth for like 2 weeks, and then I disappear into the writing schedule again. But that's where my fans hang out. You can find me in just about any bookstore. Bookstores know what to do with my science fiction. They're a little less sure what to do with my fantasy. So it's kind of like, I'm not sure where they're going to put the fantasy books, at Barnes and Noble, but
Well, I usually find you because Weber is very close to Willett on the bookshelf.
Yeah, well, it's like I was very fortunate to be able to call Roger Zelazny a friend before he died. And when we were at cons, we would be, in Author's Alley, we would find ourselves sitting next to each other because of W and Z. I have to say, it's been a heck of a ride the last 30 years. I've been very fortunate in how well the books have done. And I've been very fortunate to be allowed to do something that I loved to do and actually get paid for it, which is kind of cool. I do miss academia, but I do think that where I wound up is probably an even better fit for me.
Well, I'm glad you wound up there because I've enjoyed your books over the years, and I want to thank you very much for coming on the World Shapers today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That brings us to the end of another episode of The World Shapers. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David Weber as much as I did. There will be many more great interviews to come. People like David Brin, Lee Modisett Jr., Peter V. Brett, Tosca Lee, There's a ton of them headed our way, and I'm looking forward to every one of them. I hope you are too. Just a reminder that World Shapers can be found online at theworldshapers.com. The Twitter feed is at The World Shapers, and you can also find The World Shapers on Facebook. And you can find me, your genial host, at edwardwillett.com, EdwardWillett.com. I'm on Twitter at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook as Edward Willett. Thanks for listening to another episode of The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process, and I hope you will check out all of the other episodes that have already been recorded, and come back for all of the episodes that will be coming your way in the future. That's it for this time around. Bye for now.